Today's Tesho will be on Case 8 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Case 8 is entitled Zuigan's Eyebrows. Engo's introduction. The enlightened person enjoys perfect freedom and active life. He is like a dragon supported by deep waters, or like a tiger that commands its mountain retreat. The person who is not awakened drifts about in the affairs of the world. He is like a ram that gets its horns caught in a fence, or like a man who waits for a rabbit to run against a tree stump and stun itself. The enlightened person's words are sometimes like a lion crouched to spring, sometimes like the diamond king's treasure sword. Sometimes their effect is to shut the mouths of the world-famed ones. Sometimes it is as if they simply follow the waves coming after one another. When the enlightened person meets others who are enlightened, then friend meets friend. He values them and they encourage each other. When he meets those who are adrift in the world, then teacher meets student. His way of dealing with such people is far-sighted. He stands firm before them like a 1,000-foot cliff. Therefore, it is said that the way of the Absolute is manifest everywhere. It has no fixed rules and regulations. The teacher sometimes makes a blade of grass stand for the golden-faced Buddha, 16 feet high, and sometimes makes the golden-faced Buddha, 16 feet high, stand for a blade of grass. Tell me, on what principle is all this based? Do you understand? See the following. Main subject. Zuigan, at the end of the summer session, spoke to the assembly and said, "During the summer session I have talked to you a great deal. Now look, has Zuigan any eyebrows?" Hofuku said, "He who commits theft has a guilty conscience." Choke said, "They've grown." Umon said, Khan. Secho's verse. Zuigan's words, unanswerable in thousands of years. Umon's Khan, losing his money, committing a crime. Dotard Hofuku. He was nimble, or did he mumble? Long-tongued Zuigan, definitely a thief. Flawless is the jewel. Who can appraise the price? Choke knew well, he said, "They have grown." I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning on this summer day to practice Zen. It was really quite lovely out there this morning. Maybe when we have our picnic this afternoon, the weather will hold up. It's cool, it's sunny. You couldn't really ask for a better day. Of course, the rains might come, you know, or it might just get very, very hot. You never know. But anyway, everybody came here this morning to sit, and after we break, we're going to have we'll have a nice lunch together. That'll be wonderful in itself. Some people who are beginning Zen practice might not really understand certain elements of what we do. Whenever I give the introductory talk on Zen practice, I always try to emphasize that Zen is not a path of devotion. I always say this to beginners. I give a little speech about how to sit on the cushion, how to hold the back, how to be balanced, how to breathe through the dantian, the hara. And I I usually end by introducing the bows, the practice of bowing. And I always say, you know, Zen is not a path of devotion. And if I have time, I will explain a little bit more what I mean. And usually there isn't time because often what happens is I'll start explaining how to meditate, and then several people will come in late, and then I'll start again, and then it's about 7:30 and I have to wrap things up. But when I have the time, I'll explain that there's nothing wrong with devotional paths. Different religions in the world are highly devotional, and within Buddhism itself, there's devotional paths. So, like Pure Land Buddhism is a devotional path. But Zen is really based upon knowledge or investigation. And I always say this, idea that, you know, Zen is really not based upon devotion. Even though you can have a devotional practice along with your Zen if you want, on my altar at home, I have a statue of Guanyin, and I have a statue of the Buddha. And so, if you want to have a devotional practice, there's nothing wrong with that. But in essence, Zen is really investigation. And yet, you know, it's kind of puzzling, isn't it? Because when we come into the Zendo, if we're mindful, we bow, you know. So actually, it's not really emphasized here in our community, but in many places, when you actually enter the Zendo, you bow. And when you leave the Zendo, you bow. And when you come to your cushion, you bow. And actually, you're bowing, coming and going to your cushion. When you come into Dokusan, you bow to the altar at Dokusan. And when you leave Dokusan, you bow to the altar at Dokusan. There's a lot of bowing in Zen practice. And if you've ever come to Sesshin, you know that other aspects of our practice are also very ritualistic. So, for example, when we eat our meals, we don't just have like cafeteria style. We have three bowls, and there's no talking, and the bowls are arranged in a standardized way, with the rice bowl on the left, and the soup bowl in the middle, and the vegetable bowl on the right. And we recite sutras when we as we undo our bowls, and we recite sutras after we've washed our bowls and cleaned up, and before we leave the table. This morning, if you came at 7 o'clock, we recited sutras at 7, and just now we recited sutras again. And of course, we often do prostrations, right? Not just bowing, coming into the temple, and bowing to the cushion. As we come in, bowing to the cushion as we leave, but we do three bows at the beginning of the morning, and we do three bows at the end. So there is a kind of a ritualistic aspect of Zen that seems to contradict what I say when I say this is a path of knowledge. You know, this is a path of investigation. Because I really think it is true. I think it is true that Zen is really not about devotion. So often in devotional practices, they're centered on a devotion to a particular, like a deity, or to a bodhisattva, like Amitabha, Amida. And in Western religion, like in Christianity, people often pray to Jesus or to God or to the Virgin Mary. Anyway, these are like classical devotional practices. But Zen, I think, really is different because, the spirit of Zen is, I think, quite unique. You know, it's really about asking. It's about asking what's real, asking what exists, and not starting with an answer already in place. Now it is true, you know, you have to have confidence in this path. You know, you have to believe that this is worth doing. But even that is really something you have to work out for yourself. You know, in traditional religions, one of the things you receive are principles of the faith. So in Christianity, for example, when people are adults, become adults in the community, they have to be able to state what's called a catechism, which is the principles of the faith, the basic beliefs. And a similar arrangement exists in Judaism, too. The thing is that when you start doing Zen practice, actually, nobody hands you a book and says, these are the basic principles of Zen. If you were to practice in another tradition, that might not be the case. You might spend a long time studying sutras or teachings, and you might even get quizzed on it, you know. But in Zen, that's not what happens. You know, basically, you come into the Zen hall, and somebody shows you how to sit, and you start sitting, and a teacher might ask you at some point how it's going with your practice. And there are even more extreme cases of getting no instruction or very little direction. You know, so there's a wonderful book that I've recommended before by a guy named Clark Strand. And Clark Strand, the book is called The Wooden Bowl. But Clark Strand was a college student, I think, in maybe the Carolinas. And he heard about a Chinese monk who was living in a house in the middle of nowhere. It really didn't make any sense, you know. This was there was some university in the area, and out in the country there was a little house, and there was a Chinese monk, or there was a actually out in the country there was a little neighborhood, like a little rural neighborhood, and in one of the houses in the neighborhood there was a Chinese monk. And at the university, the word about this Chinese monk had gotten around, and so Clark Strand went out to visit the monk with his friends. And the monk was, the students were expecting the monk to say, okay, you know, here's what you have to do, here's the principles of Buddhism, etc., etc. And the monk didn't do any of those things. They came into his house and he served him some tea, and after a while he said, well, goodbye, you know, and they were baffled, you know. He didn't try to convert them to his religion, you know. And some of them never came back, but Clark came back, and you know, one day he came and the monk was sitting doing zazen. There were some extra cushions, and so he sat down next to the monk, and you know, they just sat there for a long time, and then finally the monk got up and served him some tea and said, well, thank you, you know. And he got to know this monk quite well, and they sat together for a number of years. And then Clark Strand began to feel discontent with the instruction he was getting from this monk. And he left, and he graduated from college anyway, and he went to a Zen center in central New York. actually it was Daibosatsu Zendo. And he studied with Edo Roshi for a number of years. But when he wrote this book, he said, I realized that even though Edo Roshi was a very good teacher, I realized that this other teacher was, this Chinese teacher was even a better teacher. Because he left it all up to me. He left it all up to me. Now, you know, I myself benefited enormously from having things explained to me, you know. So I don't know if I had gone in to see that Chinese teacher if I would ever have gotten interested in Zen or not, you know. Maybe I would have, but it's hard to say. A little bit of structure is a good thing. When I was doing koan training with Genki Roshi, he didn't give you very many hints. You know, in fact, he never gave people any hints. You know? So when I was working on the breath perception koan, I didn't have any idea what I was supposed to be doing. He just would say, watch your breath. And I'd come in and go, well, I'm watching, you know. Or sometimes he'd say, breath with eyes, where do you go? Right? And I just didn't know what he was talking about. So for years, I would go into Dokusan, and he never said, here's what I really want you to do. Try this, or anything like that. He just taught in a very classical way, which was like, you figure it out. And it wasn't aggressive. It wasn't like, you go figure it out. Right? He was leaving me a space to discover something really wonderful. Like most Americans, I have not been given that space very often, you know. We go to school, in fact, most modern people spend maybe 16 years sitting at a desk taking notes, right? First you have to learn how to write, and then when you've learned how to write, you can take notes. And then for the next 15 years, you take notes, right? And it's all highly structured. But Zen is really is this wonderful opportunity not to have it all highly structured. And I must say that probably when I started teaching, I wasn't ready for that. And I really wanted some structure. And fortunately, I had some structure, you know. But I've been doing this for 35 years, you know, or almost 35 years. And there's something really unique about a practice like this, because every time I sit down on the cushion, it's different. And it's different in interesting ways, actually, you know. I think some of Zen practice is learning how to be attuned to what's happening in the moment, and to sort of be alert to what's happening in the moment. And if you can cultivate that mind, everything becomes very alive and very responsive. It's really very beautiful. But as I say, it makes people a little nervous at first because we've been conditioned to have things delivered to us in little packages. So when you study algebra, there's like algebra 1 and then there's algebra 2. And every couple of weeks every couple of nights you do the even questions or the odd questions, and they introduce a new function. And you learn the function, and then you take the test. And at the end of the year, your performance is assessed with a grade. Many people in this room probably took Algebra 1. But you know, if you were from, you probably took Algebra 1. And yet, you know, I imagine that unless you're a scientist, you have no idea what algebra's for, you know? Isn't that interesting? Or calculus. You know, When we study mathematics in school, we never study the reasons these maths were invented. Isn't that, maybe it's different in India or China, but in America, you just get the math. So no, you know, once in a while you get a word problem, like a train is going east at 40 miles an hour, another train is going west at 50 miles an hour, you know, if they leave at this time, when will they meet? You know, you do get an occasional question like that, but mostly it's all very abstract. It's very simplified. And we're used to that. And also, in our personal lives, you know, there's a lot of packaging around the way we experience things. Even in morality, there's a lot of packaging. So we're told, in the Western tradition, morality is understood to start with like the Ten Commandments, you know. So the idea is that everybody was very lawless. And then Moses went up on a mountain and received the Ten Commandments from God, and he brought them down, and everybody was behaving lawlessly, and Moses got upset, but everybody eventually decided that they would follow these Ten Commandments. See? And this is sort of how we look at life, right? So we like to have things broken into pieces, you know, like algebra 1 and algebra 2, and we like to have a grade periodically. We like it all sort of like laid out for us in our education, and also like in our personal lives. So there's like a first commandment, second commandment, and you're supposed to follow the commandments, you know. And my feeling is that Zen is quite different from that, you know, because it really doesn't say, here is what you should do and here is what you shouldn't do. It doesn't say, here is who you are and here is who you're not. You know, it doesn't say, you should be like this and you shouldn't be like this. You know, Zen is, I think, quite different from that. When people do breath perception meditation, often, I mean, when my teacher gave me breath perception meditation, I was a little bit disappointed. Because I thought when I started doing Zen, we would have special, magical, something magical would happen. You know, so I had imagined, and this is incredibly stupid, I know, but, you know, everybody has a part in their mind where they have fantasies, you know. Everybody has like a storehouse of little fantasies. And as somebody who had grown up believing in telepathy in Tibet and things like that, I thought maybe I would go to see Genki Roshi, and even though my ordinary life was very stressful and a little bit dull, I would go to see Genki Roshi in Dokusan, and he would give me like special mental exercises I could do, and then I would have these amazing powers. You know, when I just started doing Zen, I kind of thought it might be like that. It was a little bit, you know, when I was a little kid, when I first went to school, like in kindergarten, I was so eager to go to school. I thought it was going to be so exciting. All the other kids, you know, I was stuck at home with my mother and my little brother, and all the kids would go off to school, and it just seemed like the most amazing thing. And then I went to school, and it was nothing like what I expected. And I had grown up on like Walt Disney movies, like Son of Flubber and things like that. And there's always some nutty professor who's mixing chemicals and comes up with crazy discoveries, right? And the thing I wanted to find at school was the laboratory. I was so excited. I thought, we're going to get to work with test tubes in a laboratory, you know? And I remember the janitor showed us around. This was in kindergarten, and the janitor of the school showed us around the school. And I kept asking him for the laboratory, but he took me to the lavatory. And it was no, the laboratory. I don't think he knew what a laboratory was. You know, it's so disappointing. Well, Dokusan was like that too, a little bit. You know. I went into Dokusan and Genki Roshi said, "Watch your breath." You know, and I have to admit that people had already told me, you know, breathe with the Dantian, breathe with the Hara, etc., etc. But it was so disappointing. I thought, "Come on, that's for babies. You know, give me the real training." I didn't follow the instructions. Right? I thought there's nothing to learn from watching the breath. I know all about the breath. Give me a real, and by the way, you know, now that I am a teacher, I've had this response from a number of students over the years, like, you know, come on, you know, get me off of this. This is for babies. Give me the real Zen, you know. And it, you know, it wasn't until many years later that I realized that I didn't know any, I had a textbook understand, I had a common sense understanding of the breath. And I had a textbook understanding. I knew the O2 went in and the CO2 went out and so on. I'd seen pictures of my lungs in textbooks of lungs, you know. But I had never really experienced the breath for myself in an aware way. So, you know, I could get into samadhi, but I just didn't pay attention. And it was many years later that I began to watch the breath, and these wonderful things would happen, right? So the breath would go out, and my mind, I eventually noticed, you know, that my mind became very blank. It took me about 10 years, maybe not quite 10 years, but it took me a long time, maybe like 5 years, to notice this. And that was what Genki meant when he said, breath with eyes, where do you go? But it took me a long time to just notice what's actually happening. And of course, when you watch the breath, you go into samadhi itself. Your body feels different. You feel different in many different ways. The character of your awareness changes, sometimes in many different ways. You might feel like you're floating or expanding or bodiless or... You know, I never noticed any of that because I wasn't educated into asking these questions, to being alert to things on my own, you know. And it took me a long time, but when I did discover what the breath is, I realized this is really quite amazing. Even if you have, you're aware of all this, you know, it's easy not to realize just how amazing it is that when you watch your breath, you go into an alternative state of consciousness. Just sitting still and watching the breath produces an alternate consciousness. And it actually produces a consciousness in which, like, self-awareness disappears periodically, and in which, like, ordinary thinking becomes... Less overwhelming, you know. And eventually you notice that your mind is becoming blank or dark, you know. And that's just, that's amazing, really. Who would have guessed? There's a person who isn't here today, but she wrote me an email and she said, you know, the darndest thing happened to me. I went with a friend to a waterfall up in New Jersey. And she said, we sat down in front of the waterfall, and all of a sudden I dropped into the deepest samadhi. I was so happy for her. You know, that takes great self-cultivation to make a discovery like that. You know, that it's a great pity that we spend so much time in just a few forms of mental life, right? Just we normally live in a very small world, you know, in terms of our awareness of things, very small cognitive world. You know, we just have a few states of mind that we keep rehearsing over and over and over again, and then we get very bored, right? But if you simply watch the breath, you enter into this very panoramic awareness. You know, everything becomes very lively. And this woman just, you know, people go up and they look at the waterfall and they talk about politics and they're thinking about the latest article on the internet, or they're upset about this, or they're worried about that. But this person had learned how to be in a different state of awareness, and she looked at the waterfall and just dropped into samadhi. And it's just wonderful. Zen is really all about entering into a state of focused awareness. You know, so you watch the breath and the mind becomes one-pointed. This phrase, one-pointed mind, goes all the way back to the Buddha himself. He actually uses that phrase. It's like normally the mind is like scattered, right? So your consciousness is on this, and then it flips to this, and then it flips to that. And as it's flipping around, you have all of these conditioned emotional responses, right? And people are just like driven from pillar to post by this, right? People go through the whole day just like rehearsing these obsessive loops in their head. And they're nervous. You know, sometimes I'll talk to people who have some crisis coming up, and all they're doing is like rehearsing it over and obsessively. And this is like ordinary consciousness, you know. But in Zen, you know, we learn how to enter this samadhi mind. This actually mind, we say mushin, the samadhi of mushin. So there's actually many different kinds of samadhis. Samadhi is like a focused awareness or a unified mind. But we unify ourselves with mushin, ushin. And when we do that, we begin to observe. Once we've done that, we're ready to start observing the world. So Zen practice is all about first entering samadhi, first developing one-pointed mind, then entering samadhi, and then finally entering ushin, and then from that standpoint, investigating reality. And koans sort of are like pointing to some aspect of reality. In some traditions of Zen, they don't use koans. Like in Soto Zen, people practice awareness, moment-to-moment awareness. Now, a lot of people who do Soto Zen don't really know what they're doing, right? And not just conceptually, but also they really don't practice with focused attention. But sooner or later they'll notice that what they're really doing is observing the moment and becoming one with the moment, right? The great Soto, Japanese Soto teacher Dogen said, to follow the way is to study the self. See? To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become unified with all things. So those are like the three stages, right, in sitting down on a cushion. First, you become, you say, quote unquote, go inside, right? Even though inside and outside are just a mental construct. We sit down with ourselves on the cushion. To study the self. When you begin to develop one-pointed mind, self-awareness disappears. So to study the self is to forget the self. And then you observe the world and become one with the world as you observe it. You know. So this is Zen practice. And it's different kind of radically different, really, from having somebody say, "Here's the truth. Now live it out. Here are the Ten Commandments. Now live it out." What we're really saying is, there's a wonderful painting. If you ever have a chance, if you're sitting in front of your computer, and you have a chance, you might write, "Who are we? Where do we come from, and where are we going? Who are we? Where do we come from, and where are we going?" This is actually the subject, that's a title, actually, of a painting by a painter I really like. His name was Paul Gauguin. And Monsieur Gauguin did this beautiful painting, and it shows three stages in a woman's life, actually. And it's really quite stunning painting. But the spirit of that painting is even more wonderful, I think, because, traditional culture's job is to tell you, here's who you are. Here's where you come from, and here's where you're going. But that's not what Zen does. Zen says, let's really investigate. Who are you? When Bodhidharma met Emperor Wu of Liang, the emperor said, "Who are you?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." See, that's a beautiful answer. Still checking, he should have said, right? Still checking. But that's the spirit of Zen. It's like, when something bothers you, what people often do is worry, right? You get into obsessive loop. But that's not the Zen way. The Zen way is to enter deep wuxin. Then you might be able to notice, like, the source of your anxiety, source of your fear. Now, that's not the normal way people deal with anxiety. Normally, people are looking for somebody who will make their anxiety go away or tell them what their anxiety is all about. So, you might go to the bookstore and get a book on dealing with anxiety and so on and so on. But the Zen approach is to be in a blank mind, in a deep wuxin, and then investigate. Where is this coming from? Not, this is the Zen approach. This means that people can make a lot of, you can be very confused sometimes. You can be genuinely confused. In fact, you definitely will be if you practice, especially if you practice wholeheartedly. You will make some mistakes, right? You'll make mistakes. That's okay, because even if somebody could tell you how you are actually supposed to live, I'm not sure it would be any help, because you wouldn't really know how to live out the instructions. You still have to discover for yourself. So Zen is quite unique because it doesn't start with rules. It doesn't start with answers. It says, let's live our lives in a questioning mode, right? Let's investigate. What is the self? What is the self? People could go back to the original teachings of the Buddha, but that would be helpful. Please read them if you'd like. But the Zen way is to sit on the cushion, and every once in a while you'll notice that you become aware of yourself, right? And the Zen approach is to say, well, where does that awareness come from? And what is it really all about, right? Now, again, it's not about doing philosophy, there's two different kinds of thinking. There's a kind of thinking which is like developing long chains of sentences, and they're linked together by association. And you pull in quotations or ideas and so on and so on. That's a normal discursive intellect. And it's not what we do. When we are working on a Zen question, we're in mushin, and in that state, ideas and language are not so pressing. They're sort of at the margin. So your mind might be blank, and then you're observing self arise. Now, what's going to happen is you're going to go, self is arising. See? That thought's okay. There's a distinction between kind of like mental labeling or posing a question, and it, which has to be phrased at in language or as a concept, right? And thinking in long chains of reflections, right? So when you sit down on the cushion and you go, who am I? Well, I remember Plato said this, you know. And then, of course, Descartes, and then, see, that's not meditation. That's sort of like reflection, discursive reflection. But when you're observing, you're in mushin and you're observing, there's all of a sudden you notice you become aware of yourself. And then that awareness usually disappears again, and then it comes back. So you're observing this. It's okay to use some language. But that's the Zen mode, right? And we use this to deal with our problems too, you know. Let's say you have an argument with a friend, you know, you don't know, you have an argument with a friend, and usually when people have arguments, it's very hard to see who is, quote, right and who is, quote, wrong, right? You might want to go find somebody who would ratify your view of things. So you might go to another friend and you'd tell the story in a way that would make the person you just had an argument look bad, right? You'd say, well, you know, then he yelled at me. You know, naturally, I, being totally peaceful, you know, responded with a very gentle voice, you know. And incredibly, he got even angrier, you know. What's wrong with that jerk, right? You know. We could tell this. I mean, we tend to tell the story in our own minds that way, and we might tell the story to a friend, and the friend is supposed to go, "Oh, he is a jerk, and you're a wonderful person, right?" But you know, the Zen way is to enter a deep mushin, and treat the event as a koan, as a question. And so if there's something about your own behavior you're in doubt about, you know, as you sit down on the cushion, you enter that blank mind, probably if that event is troubling you, you know, parts of the event are going to pop back up in your awareness. You're going to suddenly become aware of some particular moment in your heated exchange. And you may suddenly feel shame for your behavior or embarrassment. Or you might feel compassion for the person you were so angry about. Or you might decide that you were right to stand up for yourself. See? Well, this is a different way of dealing with our problems than, you know, you could go to a book that says, always be compassionate, right? But that doesn't nearly necessarily help you because it's not always clear what compassion means, you know. So the Zen approach is to enter this investigating mind, and your mind can become very skillful at investigating and perform in ways you might not be used to if you have only been doing this for a little while. But the mind has amazing powers to reveal to you what's important about an event, and to show you, you know, where you made a mistake or where you did the right thing. So there's like a deeper intelligence in the human being. And Zen is all about tapping into that. And I think this is a superior approach myself. You know, rules don't get you very far in life. The Ten Commandments are a good idea, you know? So there's ten of them. And originally there were ten, right? And it's things like don't kill people, don't steal, don't commit adultery, and so on and so on. And these are good, right? Having these, but the problem is applying them can be complicated, right? I mean, if it says don't steal, that seems clear enough. But you know, there are cases where taking something might be necessary to help somebody, right? And you're sort of left uncertain about what to do. Maybe, you know, somebody when there was a flood in New Orleans, you know, some people broke into a grocery store to get food because there was no legally available food. Now, you know, is that stealing or not? You know? So rules are really not necessarily don't necessarily solve the problem, you know. The other problem with rules is that people can bullshit themselves to an extraordinary degree, right? So, you know, you might be dealing with finances and you might think, well, you know, is it really stealing? After all, I'm using it for a good cause. You know, no, it's not stealing, it's actually like Robin Hood, you know. So people reason that way all the time, right? They deceive themselves a lot. So I think this idea of Zen, this Zen approach is a better approach, you know. You really have to face your true nature. You sit down on the cushion and you go into deep wuxin, and maybe you see your fears, you see your anxieties, your dreams, that and so on, laid out before you, and you kind of see them at a distance. And then all of a sudden it might occur to you, you know, this is really stealing. Even if it's not legally stealing, you might decide this is really stealing. So this requires a lot of trust in the process and in this true nature inside of human beings. But this is what Zen is all about, you know. So you know, when people come up to me and they have questions about their practice, I'm really happy to hear that, because that shows they're really practicing, you know. Zen is not just about being in sort of like a happy state, you know. So if we could just come in and sit down on the cushion and enter bliss, that would not be productive, really. It wouldn't be good for us. We can enter Mushin, and then we begin to work through our obstacles. And then we begin to ask questions about, you know, who are we, where do we come from, and where are we going? And that's a process that really never stops. And it's why this practice, I think, is so interesting. But I haven't really gotten to this whole issue yet of all this bowing. You know, what are we doing all this? If this is true, if everything I said is true, and we don't believe in fixed rules, and we look into the true nature for ethical guidance, why are we bowing? You know? And that's an interesting question. A part of it is that we're, sooner or later in your practice, if you do practice Zen long enough, I think you're going to want to bow to your cushion, really. It's going to feel really wonderful to bow to your cushion. But the other function of bowing is that it's a way of, it's about harmonizing ourselves with the world and with one another. It's like an expression of intention, right? So, you know, most people are not bodhisattvas when they start sitting. Most people are angry, envious, fearful, lustful, jealous, selfish, on and on. This is a fact. And so we're quite far from being bodhisattvas, you know. But there's a kind of will to awaken. It's actually called bodhicitta. Bodhicitta. It's like the desire to be enlightened. And when this is awakened, it's really like a very important moment in Zen practice. And And, you know, bowing could be understood as the expression of desire to wake up, like the expression of desire, of the desire to wake up. And this is why, like in Tibetan Buddhism, people do thousands of bows. And you can think, what is that all about, you know? But it's really deep, you're cultivating a mind of bodhicitta. It's like, I'm expressing my desire to wake up. And I think it's very profound, you know. So every time you're bowing, you're really saying, you're saying to the people around you, I honor enlightenment in you, but you're also saying with your whole body, I want to be an enlightened being. I want to be a bodhisattva. I want to be a Buddha. And the other element of this, which is so important, is that we do it together. You know, all day long we live in our own worlds, but when we come together to practice, we're all expressing this desire to wake up together. During Sesshin, I mentioned this, that, you know, in ancient Chinese culture, people realized that rules don't necessarily produce good behavior. So in the West, we have the Ten Commandments, but as I said, you know, it's not always clear how to interpret the commandments. And even if you have Ten Commandments, you can twist them around if your heart isn't right. You know, so if you want to have an affair with somebody who's married, you can always say, well, it says, you know, you shouldn't commit adultery, but really, you know, this woman, her husband really isn't much of a husband. You know, so this isn't really adultery, you know, that kind of thing. You know, people do that every day. So laws, rules that are written down, are still subject to like all kinds of bullshit. You know, we can bullshit ourselves. So the ancient Chinese noticed this, and they said, you know, what we really need to do a ritual together. And this is like Confucian idea. You know, Confucius didn't really believe in he thought maybe there might be a god and there might not, but he didn't care. He really thought the most important thing was being humane. And he said, you know, rules don't necessarily make people right-hearted. So the way to do it is to change their hearts by acting together. So we all bow together. See, we're all saying, I really want to wake up. I want to wake up. I want to be an enlightened being. And when we do this together, it's mutually reinforcing, right? It also creates a deep connection. It's like you support me and I support you. And this is, I think, very profound. And you know, the odd thing is that you could start bowing and think, this is a bunch of bullshit. You know, but if you keep doing it, after a while, you're going to feel like a deep sense of gratitude. It's very strange. It's like people sit down on the cushion and they think nothing's going to happen, and one day they enter deep samadhi. It's just like that, you know. So anyway, Suigan, at the end of the summer session, spoke to the assembly and said, "During the summer session, I have talked to you a great deal. Now look, has Suigan any eyebrows?" So, you know, basically, he's saying, when you have a question, use your own ushin to invest. Do I have eyebrows or not? You know, and it's like, don't think about what other people would say. Go into deep mushin and then look for yourself and see what you discover. Look for yourself and see what you discover. So at the end of the summer, he said, "I've been giving teishos all summer long, and those are just words and ideas. Ultimately, Zen practice is about finding the law, finding the Dharma, the right path in yourself." So it's one thing when people give it to you, you have to find inside of you is Buddha, inside of you is a bodhisattva. You know, our behavior, our conduct, is often not Buddha-like, right? we aren't always behaving in a way that's worthy of the Buddha inside us, the Buddha we really are. Yeah? But we keep bowing and expressing the desire to wake up. And we keep investigating. During the summer session, I have talked to you a great deal. Now look, do I have eyebrows or not? He says, don't use common sense. Don't use intellect. Go into deep ushin and then look, look, look. Investigate. What are eyebrows anyway? Okay. Hofuku said, ha, he who commits a theft has a guilty conscience. So that's his answer, see? Hofuku says, ha, he who commits a theft has a guilty conscience. What does that mean? Well, that's you have to, that's part of the koan. But the point is, he has his own experience of the eyebrows. Yeah? Okay, next, Choke says, they've grown. See? Another they've grown. See? Beautiful answer, right? Oh, beautiful answer. His answer. Umon says, Khan. His answer. This is the essence of Zen. This is like a deeper morality. Actually, more demanding morality, right? More demanding. Rules are easy. This is like you have to know in the atoms of your being that this is the right way to live. This is the right act to do. Right? So this is very, very high standard, but very beautiful. Secho's verse. Suigan's words, unanswerable in thousands of years. Umon's Khan, losing his money, committing a crime. Dotard Hofuku. Was he nimble or did he mumble? Long-tongued Suigan, definitely a thief. Flawless is the jewel. Who can appreciate the priceless? Choke knew well. He said, they have grown. Yeah. If you live this way, in my opinion, I too am not a Buddha, you know. So I fail every day in some way, and I do my bows and say, I want to be a Buddha, I want to be an enlightened being. And I get back on the cushion and investigate. You know. I think it's a beautiful way to live, and obviously you do too, because you're here. So please continue to practice this beautiful path, and now we can break and we can go have a wonderful lunch on a beautiful summer day.